Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Namvula Mashwai Cook is a force of nature. For over a decade, she's sought out the talented women crafters of her South African homeland, creating markets for their goods and, in the process, changing their lives forever. You'll want to hop on the first plane to Africa when you hear what Namvula is cooking up. Then, this week's Splendid Table episode is all about Louisiana food. Get ready to hear Lynn Rosetta Casper's take on our delicious state. We're going behind the scenes with Lynn and road food mavens Jane and Michael Stern. Then, author Molly Stevens joins us to discuss her new book, all about roasting. There's lots of exotic flavors to taste on this week's Louisiana Eats. I first met Namvula Mashwai Cook when she traveled from South Africa to be part of the Jazz and Heritage Festival in 2004. Since then, Namvula has remained my very long-distance electronic pen pal. Namvula is joining us by phone to tell us of her latest projects with the crafts and foodways of South Africa. Namvula, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. I'm happy to be here, and greetings to you and your listeners.
You are such a well-traveled person. You're in Washington, D.C. right now at the Folk Festival. I know that you spent some time in Santa Fe and New Orleans. What is it that you learn in all of your travels, and does it make you see South Africa maybe a little differently?
You know, Poppy, they say in order to appreciate your own hometown where you come from, you ought to go somewhere and see places and meet people. And that's what has happened with me throughout my travels. And when I came to New Orleans Jazz Festival, really that shaped my perception about the food. Even though I had brought in a big, huge group of crafters to New Orleans, what really I walked away with was an incredible space when it comes to food, food ways, preparing food, seasoning food, presenting food, and eating food.
Well, we did have some fun in both of those categories. Would you tell us a little bit about your memories of being here in New Orleans?
Well, when I think about the 2004 trip that I made to New Orleans, to tell you the truth, Poppy, when I left South Africa coming to your place, I did not know what to expect. And as we went through the festivals, we realized that it wasn't only just festival. It was building relationships simply because of the presentations that we were doing. And I remember coming to the Zatarain's stage where, Poppy, you were the master and putting everything together. And I just learned so much from your techniques. I just learned so much from your great, great energy. And by the time we left, we really left with a big, big piece of wonderful memory from New Orleans Jazz Festival.
We really did have a great time there on the Zatarain's Food Heritage Stage. That was a great, great time. Let's talk about what we cooked, because we really surprised the people. And yet, in some ways, the food was familiar to us, too.
It was amazing. Because when I got to the Zatarain stage, I realized that the South African food, the cuisine that I was presenting, people had a lot of appreciation for what I was presenting. Primarily, we actually tried a lot of exciting cuisines. We started with what we call makwinya. Makwinya is a staple in South Africa. It's like a deep fried bread. It would be something like a donut, what you'd call a donut, but with less sugar in it because we use it as eating our food with and as part of our cuisine. And then we also did, if you remember, Papi, we did the greens.
Well, yes.
That were very highly seasoned.
Well, you all eat greens and we eat greens. So.
Exactly. And I just realized that there is just so much similarities between our foods. I mean, food is food to everybody.
So tell me, we'd like to hear about this organization that you have put together that you're working with now.
You know, right now I'm the executive director of Mpumalanga Traditional Art Market. The abbreviation for that is MCAM. And that is actually an initiative that came out of the Kellogg Foundation that supported me generously to come here to the United States to be trained under the leadership of the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market, which is in New Mexico. And I came here and I trained for about plus minus 6 months. And this was to make sure that I can get the model of what they are doing in Santa Fe and hopefully translate that into our own terrain back in the southern region.
And so now you are starting a craft market in South Africa, correct?
Now I'm starting a craft market in South Africa that happens every September, the last weekend of September. September is a very important month for us in South Africa because it's Heritage Month.
What's that all about?
What we are saying to South Africans and our neighbors is through that month, we are restoring our cultural memories. We don't want to lose or forget about our history, our culture, and our connectivity as a people. So we take that month of September and highlight certain aspects of our cultures, including, you know, traditions in visual arts, in traditional arts, and in indigenous food. But so we take that opportunity during that time to reflect and to be thankful that in this new South Africa, we are able to move forward.
I know that some of the pieces that you are offering at the market, of course, now they are considered art, but they were originally created for very simple uses, yes?
Absolutely. Let me give you the pottery. The pottery that you find in South Africa, you will find that that was the pottery that was actually used to collect water, to collect beer, the homemade beer. But now, in the basketry, you'll find that we use that to store our dried foods and to store sorghum. But now, because our culture, of course, culture is not static. We are trying to accommodate the new buyer that is looking at this traditional art form to take home, but to use it as decor material. So when you look at our collection right now, you will see that it's traditional, it's transitional, it's contemporary.
So describe some of the crafts for us. What are some of these things that are included in the market?
You know, our market, we say, is an art market that aims to promote, preserve, and encourage the indigenous cultures and heritage of the region. So what you see there, if you were to come to our market, you'd be seeing incredible beadwork that is done by the Ndebele people. You'd see their most incredible murals, paintings that are done by the Ndebele women. You'd see textile. We have wood carving. We have pottery. Our pottery comes as far as Limpopo in the Venda area. We have jewelry. And, of course, we cannot have the market without having food.
You have food at the market.
Well, we have food.
Tell us about that.
You cannot do a market without food. What we do at our market is we prepare traditional food so that we can give those that come to join us at our festival a taste of South Africa and a taste of the region. We prepare food such as, I would say it's like barbecue, what you'd call a cookout.
Ah.
You'd probably call it a cookout. In South Africa, we call it a braai. We braai and roast the meat. And sometimes we will roast the biltong, which is very traditional when it comes to South Africa. Biltong would be something that you would call beef jerky.
Oh.
You know the beef jerky?
Yes, indeed.
We call it biltong. And we would saute our sausages in there, and we would eat that with the greens, with the millipap, with the porridge, with the gravy. We season our food just like you season your food here.
Nomvula, I know that our listeners are going to be very tempted by all this conversation, and they can actually visit your website to see some of this beautiful work, yes?
Absolutely. They can visit our website at www.mtem.co.za.
Z-A, yes.
Z-A. I'm sorry. In South Africa, we said Z. Now I forget. Here is Z-A.
Well, we will have that link on our website so that everyone can have a look at the beautiful work of your crafters and the beautiful work that you are doing there in South Africa. And thank you so much for all the years of friendship we have enjoyed. And next time you come back to the U.S., let's rendezvous.
Thank you so much, Poppy.
Nomvula Mashwai Cook of South Africa, bringing the crafts and foods of her home to the world.
Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
If you shop at the Baton Rouge Red Stick Market or the Crescent City Farmers Market in New Orleans, you're likely to have bought sweet, juicy citrus from longtime vendor Linda LaHoste. Linda and her husband, Lester, have long prided themselves on having one of the only certified organic citrus farms in the state of Louisiana. Following Hurricane Katrina in the fall of 2005, the nonprofit organization Slow Food USA became particularly interested in the Louisiana Satsuma and placed it on their Ark of Taste. Inspired by Noah's Ark, the Slow Food Ark of Taste is a catalog of delicious foods in danger of extinction. In 2005, the Satsuma had become endangered as most of the citrus orchards of Lower Plaquemine Parish were wiped out by flooding that killed the trees. Located on the east bank of the Mississippi River, the LaHoste Farm didn't experience Katrina's devastating floods and were in the unusual position of having a bumper crop of citrus to sell. But due to the diminished population and lack of operating markets, the LaHostes had very few outlets for their fruit. In order to help, Slow Food USA sent an email across the United States with the news that for $25, the LaHostes would ship a box of their endangered Satsumas, guaranteed to arrive in time for the holidays. The orders poured in, but with no way to accept payment except through the spotty mail service, Linda shipped out the Satsumas on the promise that the checks were in the mail. By January 2006, the LaHostes had received every single payment, a testimony to the inherent goodness of their slow food friends. Hurricane Isaac has left the La Hosts in a much different circumstance. This time, they were inundated with floodwaters that reached the rooftop of their Braithwaite home. The orchards were flooded, the rootstocks wiped out, and the packing shed heavily damaged. But the ever-positive Lester reports there is still viable fruit in the tops of the trees. He's planning to bring in the harvest this year, despite the incredible hardship of his current circumstance. That's why we've chosen Linda and Lester La Hoste as this week's Culinary Heritage Heroes, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens. We don't know if the La Hoste will make it back to our farmers' markets this season, but Louisiana Eats listeners can send words of encouragement to them via email at lahostecitrus@yahoo.com. That's L-H-O-S-T-E citrus. @yahoo.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and the Louisiana Satsuma is some of the finest Louisiana eats. We're taking a short break, but we'll be right back with Splendid Tables' Lynn Rosetta Casper. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Earlier this year, the whole crew of American Public Media's award-winning radio show, The Splendid Table, came to New Orleans for a live taping of Louisiana Eats. While they were here, Lynn Rosetta Casper collected interviews for a Louisiana-themed episode of The Splendid Table, scheduled to air this weekend. Don't miss it. In the meantime, here's my interview with the crew of Splendid Table, beginning with how Lynn got interested in food in the first place.
Oh, Lord. Has anyone read David Copperfield? Do you remember it began with I Was Born? Okay, I was born and raised just outside of New York City in North Jersey. And it was the kind of environment where when you stopped talking about the meal you were eating, you started talking about the meal you were going to eat.
Just like New Orleans.
Exactly. And I fell backwards into it. I was in the right place at the right time. Back in the late 60s and early 70s in New York, when the food revolution was just beginning, this immense interest in food, being Italian American, of course, my great passion was Chinese food. Well, there were two things. A, I had to get out of town. You know, I went to a high school where everybody married their sweethearts. Come on. You know, you had a big city out there right across the George Washington Bridge. So the first chance I got, I went away to college, and I ended up going to the School of the Month Club. But what I really wanted to do was to get into that city and start living a life. And I essentially became fascinated by Chinese food, which you could spend 8 lifetimes learning about. And we would do banquets every month at home. And friends started saying, would you teach us? And I said, this is ridiculous because it's me reading the book the night before the course. And the standing line was, you know the book to read, you know. So that's how it started. And then the first department store in the entire country that ever had an independent food program heard about me and asked me if I would become their, in quotes, gourmet consultant. And I thought that was a full-time job. I had a theater group, a street theater group at that time, kids theater. We did street theater and improv. And I was sort of balancing, which should I do? And I ended up taking that job. And Julia Child, the first time Julia Child cooked in public, it was in my kitchen at that store.
What was the store? Can you tell us?
Abraham and Strauss. And if you live in New York and you live in Brooklyn, New York, which is where I lived, it is an institution. And I set out to learn everything I could from everyone I could. So I'd scraped together enough money. I gave up the Chinese cooking only because I realized I had to be of that culture to really understand it. I still will be eating Asian food probably before I'll be eating Italian food because I'm a bitch about Italian food. But at any rate, the point was that I was sitting there surrounded by some of the greatest people in food. And I think the one thing I had on my side was I was smart enough to know I knew nothing. And that's how it all started.
I think everybody would really like to know about your personal life. For instance, you were in...
How personal?
Well, you know, within the bounds of exactly today, you spent some time in my home kitchen with my three Chinese pugs. So what's it like in your home kitchen?
Well, first of all, my home kitchen does not look like a magazine cover. My home kitchen has my fabulous Wolf six-burner stove. They don't even make it anymore. Her name is Babe. She's 37 inches wide. She juts out an unfashionable 30 inches from the wall. And she's got six burners, and I can put six 12-inch skillets side by side on that baby and not lose a bit of burner space. 17,500 BTU per burner.
I have burner envy. Yes,
and,
I do.
And I went around, when I went around to shop for Babe, this was, what you know how that first cookbook,
yeah.
If you have made any money, you're going to make it in the first royalty check. Everybody does something different. Well, I bought Babe. And my mother was so funny because she said, you spent that much money on a stove. It has no clock. It has no window. You can't look in it. And there's no light in the oven. Wow, you were cheated.
You have already explained to us about your very, very early relationship with Julia Child. And we actually have a little clip of you and Julia on the Splendid Table. So could we hear that little clip, please?
Julia, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Well, lovely to be with you, Lynn.
It's good to have you here. And the first thing that I want to know is, how did you begin? Because from what I understand, you didn't grow up saying, I think I want to become a food professional.
No, I was always very hungry. And my mother didn't cook at all because I grew up in the teens and 20s when everybody just about had a maid because it wasn't expensive. We had all the people, the immigration, and so almost everyone had a maid. So mother never cooked at all. She could make some funny kind of an English cheese dish. That was about it.
Now, Lynn, I can't help but say I've listened to this clip several times preparing for tonight, and it seems like there was a lot of rustling going on. What exactly was Julia doing? And could you give us a little behind-the-scenes look at that interview?
Well, let's put it this way. Julia, first of all, was wonderful, especially when the show was beginning and four people were listening. Anytime we asked, she came on. But the other thing you have to know, of course, is that Julia had been doing this for years. Julia was reading the paper. And if you notice, she's totally present, but she's reading the paper. And... that was Julia. God bless her.
Well, that must have been some sound engineer to catch all that ambient noise.
Oh, just boy. We just loved it. We really did.
I would like to invite your collaborator, your producer on the Splendid Table, your co-author of How to Eat Supper, by the way, this year's James Beard Award nominee for How to Eat Weekends. Let's welcome Sally Swift.
You've just joined us. You're listening to the live taping of Louisiana Eats Behind the Scenes with Lynn Rosetta Casper of Splendid Table.
I'm coming back. I like the band.
Sally, Lynn, give us an idea of how did this collaboration begin?
I called her. Total cold call. I had been working in television and actually working for Prince, which is a really wonderful thing to do, but you do get tired of getting the call in the middle of the night saying, get the band together, click. You know, I mean, it can get old after a while. And I had picked up Lynn's book, and I devoured it. I mean, I just was utterly stunned by it. And found out she was in St. Paul, and I had just moved back, and I was done with Prince, and you pick it up from there.
Well, the background from my side was that the book had gotten a lot of attention, and you were one of the flavors of the month, which meant television producers were approaching you. And then I get a call from Sally, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, another one. You know, but she was talking about radio, and I thought she's going to want to do a recipe show. So I thought, all right, I'll have lunch with her.
Like, so we had lunch. She was a little cool.
I was, you know.
She was a little, I mean, we left, and she basically said, well, baby, you get some money for a pilot, and we'll go. And I had money in, like, 2 weeks.
You were incredible. You really,
But we, and this is the beautiful thing about public radio, because, of course, you know, from the earth it comes in many ways, and we had these excellent partners in Minnesota Public Radio. And Lynn and I each made $80 a week for the first...
Oh, sweet.
No, $80 a show.
No. We made $25 a show.
Well, for the pilot, sweet.
You all aren't helping my career.
I know. No, I'm sorry.
No, this was 45 years ago.
It was 17 years ago, though. But
yeah. And one of the first calls you made...
was to Jane and Michael.
To Jane and Michael Stern.
Actually was the first call I made.
And how did you know about
them?
Well,
I loved them, and I had...
In those
it seemed
days,
perfect to me.
If you worked in food, you knew about these two. In fact, 90% of the people working in food who were their contemporaries wanted to kill them. Because
right.
These two had created a genre that everyone, when their first road food book came out, there were probably, I said, 90, 100 of us who were working in the 70s. Why didn't I think of this? And then you realize, if you had thought of it, would you have done it with the wit and with the smarts and the wise-ass piece, which I love. No offense, guys, but that they've done. And so it was something when Sally said the Sterns was like, oh, yeah, if we could get them, right? I mean, and we did. And we're forever thankful.
We still like each other, too, all of us,
which is pretty amazing.
And so Jane and Michael Stern, the champions of road food, please come join us at the party.
I'm going to pull these chairs over.
Of course, our house band, Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, were with us that night to provide musical interludes.
Oh, thank you. I am so glad the road brought you all to Louisiana Eats. Thank you. Give us a little snapshot into your life and what that's like.
It used to be more difficult.
We've written 42 books, and we were at Gourmet for 18 years, and we won 6 James Beard Awards, and we've been on their show for a billion years. So to fill all of those coffers, we had to travel a tremendous amount. Now that we're old and crippled, we're sort of not quite... We're working at Savoir magazine now, doing articles for them. When we first started at Gourmet, before Ruth Reichel took over, we were very intimidated because, quite frankly, we don't know crap about food.
Well, when we started writing, Gourmet was like the enemy. I was sort of who wants that pretentious stuff, you know?
So we were called in after our first article because we were in Shenandoah, Iowa. And Gail called us into the office and
she said, I have to talk to you about your expense account. We thought, oh, no.
Right. And she said, how can you possibly stay at a motel that costs $18 a night when our other food writers are in Singapore and they're spending $300 a bottle of wine? She said, you have to spend more. And we said,
those were the good old days, right?
We were at the Tall Corn Motel in Shenandoah, Iowa, which was the poshest, hotel in Shenandoah. So, we've always gone our own route. I mean, we've always been kind of weird. And the only people who got us early on were Jim Beard, who we went to see every Sunday. He became like daddy. And he had a pug named Percy, who I made cookies for, and Percy vomited them up.
Oh, no.
Right. And MFK Fisher, she took us under her wing and... so we had good people.
So out of all the places you've been and all the food you've eaten, what is the most obscure place that you traveled to, and what was the food that you went there to eat?
That cremated fish in North Carolina.
Yes.
River... you're not talking black and red fish.
No, no, it's it. No, no, it's river herring that swims up the river. We've talked about this on the show.
The
herring shacks along the Roanoke River, and from January through April, when the fish start swimming up river, they used to catch millions of them. Now they catch dozens, and you can get them either sunny side up, which is just tossed in the oil and pulled right out, or cremated, which is the way most people get them there, because you basically can eat the entire thing and you're just left with a backbone.
Well,
do you want us to tell you? We're actually doing a story now about testicle festivals all around the country, but you probably don't want to hear about that.
Well. if you want weird food, St. Louis is the weird food capital.
It is.
Because they have their brain sandwiches, pig snout sandwiches.
Gooey butter cake. It's
gooey butter cake. And what's that thing that makes no sense?
Oh, the thing that nobody can understand, the St. Paul sandwich, which is unique to St. Louis. Nobody there knows why it's called a St. Paul. It's basically egg foo young on white bread with a slice of American cheese. And very inexpensive Chinese restaurant serves it.
Wow.
And nobody knows why or how.
Okay. Well, Michael...
Yes, Poppy, why?
As clearly evidenced, you know, we'll leave the testicle festival behind.
Thank you.
But I would like to say that you have certainly displayed a big proclivity for hot dogs. You obviously...
Are we talking like in Freudian terms about this hot dog?
And the audience can be the judge of that.
You know, he starts on the splendid table... describing them taut.
Well,
muscular.
As a matter of fact,
the three of us can't.
Is this an intervention? A hot dog
let's
intervention.
Let's see how Michael really feels about hot dogs.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that in Chicago, they do make the best hot dogs in the world. And what they are all beef wieners that are cooked to a kind of perfect succulent so that when you bite into it, the skin kind of bursts and sort of garlicky beef juices flow out of the dog. And it works because these dogs are bedded down in soft poppy seed buns.
Michael,
Chicago,
yeah. Michael, this
you
is
him. He's turning.
You can't stop me.
He's turning this red as he's talking.
Wait a minute. This is food porn. I mean, we're going to be taken off the air with this stuff. But don't stop.
He's wiggling in his seat.
All right. Yeah, this is really. I really go crazy when I think about a great Chicago Red Hot because the fact is you can't get them anywhere else. Once the dog is bedded down in the bun, you tell the counterman to drag it through the garden. And what that means is, it doesn't mean just mustard, ketchup. What it means is a little yellow mustard, piccalilli, strips of green pepper, cucumber discs, pickle spears, slices of whole fresh tomato, maybe some onions, and then these little tiny incendiary peppers they call sport peppers, all on top, then a dash of celery salt. Now this is...
Take a breath, dear.
Virtually impossible.
He's really on a roll.
Oh, I can't stop.
I can hear it. I can hear it.
Just one question By any chance, have you ever encountered a Bourbon Street Lucky Dog?
No comment, okay?
Okay. Well,
let me just tell you how weird Michael is to travel with. I mean, we've been traveling together for almost 40 years, and there has never been a piece of food that has hit the table in front of him that he hasn't photographed. I mean, we have a photographic archive of, of a crust of bread from 1983.
I'm going to tell on Jane, though, because about half of my pictures, especially from the early days, are pictures of a beautiful slice of pie with one bite taken out of it. Too impatient. Right.
But Michael, this is before we all had little digital cameras, and Michael's father owned a camera store in Illinois, so we would get these, Hasselblads with, professional lighting. And we'd be in the middle of Kentucky eating a burgoo sandwich, and Michael's lighting it like Cecil B. DeMille, And people are coming up to me, and they're saying, what's he doing? And I got tired of, endlessly trying to explain what we do for a living, which nobody understands. So I said, he was just released from a mental hospital. And I said, he's harmless, but just let him do it. And people with COVID say, sir, would you like to take
Yeah, people brought me empty plates. You
know, it's much easier. Much easier.
Well, you all have certainly given us a delicious taste. Let's have a big round of applause.
That was Lynn Rosetta Casper and Road Food Mavens Jane and Michael Stern. Don't forget to tune in this Sunday for their very special All Louisiana edition of The Splendid Table. Don't go anywhere. After our next break, we're coming right back with award-winning cookbook author Molly Stevens. Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name of the Food Network series that featured Chef Jeff Henderson, is the Chef Jeff Project. On the show, Chef Jeff mentors six at-risk young youths by putting them to work in his catering company, Posh Urban Cuisine. By arming these inner-city kids with culinary knowledge and skills, Chef Jeff gives them a chance at a new life in food. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, this week our winner hails from the Big Easy. Congratulations to Elena Evans for winning our prize, and thanks to everyone out there who participated. We hope we'll hear from you this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving three full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the Louisiana Mandarin orange likely to be in short supply this season because of Hurricane Isaac? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the Louisiana Mandarin orange likely to be in short supply this season because of Hurricane Isaac? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line. And you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. One of the most magical words in the culinary dictionary is roast. Roasting virtually any food results in a delicious concentration of flavor that accentuates the virtues of a once raw ingredient. Cooking teacher and author Molly Stevens is an expert on this topic and talked with us recently to discuss her latest book, All About Roasting. In your kitchen, Molly, what are your most important roasting tools in the arsenal?
You know, that's a great question, Poppy. When I first started the book, I thought I was going to go out and buy all these fancy all-clad roasters and, you know, all this heavy-duty roasting pans. And the pans that I use the most are my, just the little baking sheet with the rim on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my workhorse roasting pan for vegetables, for pieces of poultry, for seafood. I love skillet as well, a heavy skillet. And yes, I use roasting pans. But the thing about roasting is about having as much of that hot oven air circulating around the food. So if you have one of those big old Thanksgiving turkey roasting pans, the sides are like sometimes 4 inches, 5 inches high.
Oh, that's
and if
true.
You just have a little tiny chicken thigh that's only about an inch and a half, that oven air is not going to hit it. So the lower the side of the pan for everyday roasting, the better. Sure, it's great to have a big roasting pan for when you're doing a prime rib or a pork shoulder or something big and hefty that's going to sit up high in the oven. But I love just baking sheets and skillets.
Molly, for some reason, I rarely see Gulf seafood served roasted on a menu. Why do you think people are overlooking that? And do you have some suggestions for us?
Yeah, you would know better than I about why it's being overlooked. But just for myself, being down in Louisiana and eating out, it's about boiling. It's about that's what we do, and so it's a tradition. Plus, roasting in a hot weather climate is. I mean, I'm from the Northeast, and we roast because the oven heats up our home too. So there are some cultural reasons. But having said that, now it's. What is it, 2012 or something? And you could turn on an air conditioner and turn on an oven and have an amazing dish that comes out of roasting seafood because it concentrates the flavors. I think of it as the most simple, direct, almost honest way. You get amazing textures and flavors from doing it. So I love to roast seafood, and I roast shrimp, I roast oysters, anything, little, big. You roast whole fish. It's incredible, and you get – it's similar to grilling. In terms of the results you get, you can get these brown, caramelized exteriors and crispy end bits and tender inside. So I really encourage people, even if it's not kind of your tradition to roast it, it's sure a great way to prepare seafood.
And I would think that even down here with the heat, we tend to use our barbecue pits all the time. Yeah. You could roast on the barbecue, couldn't you?
You can. You can. Anytime. Just any closed oven, which you could make. Yep.
Would you give me an idea of how you would roast a whole fish?
Again, it depends on the size. The bigger it is, the lower the temperature. But fish, unlike meat, you're not worried about it being tough. So it doesn't have to go super slow to tenderize. You just want it to be cooked so that the outside doesn't get overdone before the inside is cooked. But I clean the fish. I like to put maybe some herbs, a little citrus inside it. I love to lay the fish on a bed of herbs, so or branches of some sort, something flavorful like rosemary herbs or something like that. A little olive oil on top of it, and then I put pretty deep gashes into the flesh of it so that the heat can penetrate. And then just flip it halfway through, turn it gently halfway through. And then what I love to do with seafood is finish it with some sort of maybe a vinaigrette or a relish. In the book, I've got a whole index of different kinds, like a celery leaf salsa verde or maybe a Meyer lemon vinaigrette or cilantro and mint or just something fresh to put on at the end of it or even just a squeeze of lemon, but just something fresh to finish it.
You actually include a lot of restaurant technique secrets in the book, like your duck secret.
Yeah. this is the very slow roasted duck. And I learned this from a chef in Boston. And I think we can learn a lot from chefs, but it's important to interpret them and make them work for us at home. And I look for tips that make things easier, not more complicated. So this is a 5-hour roast duck, so it's really tender and richly flavored. And when you go to cut it up, it's hot. It's hard to cut up a hot duck and have it carve it nicely, and because it's hot and it's slippery. And so one thing you could do is cook it ahead of time, and then when it's time to eat, it's cooled off. Cut it up into serving portions very neatly because it's easy to handle and nobody's looking, and you cut it up in neat little serving portions, put those back onto a baking sheet and heat them in a really hot oven.
Fire them. There's that restaurant
technique. That's what we
say.
Fire a duck for table 67 and just fire it out or heat it up until it's cooked through, and then it gets this wonderful crackling crust on it too.
You even include a section on roasted desserts.
Well, yeah.
Let's explore that topic a little bit.
Yeah. It's in the back of a vegetable chapter, the second half, I should say, of the vegetable chapter, roasted fruits. And what happens when you roast a fruit is the sugars just get concentrated and sweeter and sweeter. So, for example, there's a recipe for roasted pineapple. I think it's brown sugar roasted pineapple. And it's basically an upside-down cake without the cake.
Mm.
And you get this incredible concentration of sugars. They're roasted grapes, they're roasted cherries, roasted plums. And the thing about, yes, they're desserts, but I find roasted fruits can sort of go either way. They can work themselves into the savory realm. So, for example, the roasted cherries are delicious with a creamy polenta. I don't know, maybe Poppy, you would agree, but we're seeing sweet come back into a lot of our savory, just as we're seeing savory into our sweets. And so roasted fruits play into that.
What about vegetables?
Oh, yeah. Roasted. You know, we think about roasting meat and poultry and the sort of, and the book has all the iconic, the Thanksgiving turkey and the prime rib and all those. But the roast vegetable chapter, that threatened to just take over the whole book. At one point, I thought I should just do roasted vegetables because they are so, so good. Broccoli, snap peas, green beans, onions, tomatoes, you name it. In the vegetable kingdom, you can roast it.
It's so easy and so delicious.
So delicious, yeah.
Well, thank you, Molly. Thanks for coming to talk with us.
Thanks, Poppy. It was a pleasure.
Molly Stevens in her new book, All About Roasting. Recently asked if it was better to use fresh herbs instead of dried. Honestly, the two are as different as apples and oranges. Generally speaking, fresh herbs are best added in the last 5 minutes of cooking in order to keep their bright flavors. Fresh herbs are lost on most of our long-cooked Louisiana dishes. By the time they've simmered in gumbos or stews, you'll never be able to tell if they were fresh or dried. In fact, some fresh herbs, like basil, become bitter if overcooked. Strip the leaves from the stems when using fresh herbs, because stems will also sometimes give your dish a bitter flavor. When substituting fresh herbs for dried in a recipe, you need 3 times the amount of fresh versus dried. You see, it's really the herbs' volatile oils that impart the flavor. Those oils are more concentrated in dried herbs. But because of that volatility, dried herbs do lose their flavor over time. Buying whole dried herbs instead of the finely ground version will extend their shelf life, as will storing them in a dark cabinet or pantry, because light will decrease their flavor life. Discard and renew your dried herb and spice selection annually to ensure you always have the freshest flavor. If you have a culinary query, email your question to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org and we'll do our best to answer you. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Hi-Hat's Chip Epperson tells us about entertaining some very special guests.
David Simon and some of his crew got there early, and then one of those big 15-passenger vans pulled up and, you know, bang, bang, bang. Just one after another got out and started walking to the front door. It was really surreal.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at WWNO.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lightsegan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer Thomas Walsh, our editors Zoe Sullivan and Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and intern Lauren Mencken. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.